Welcome to the Women in Public Policy Program Seminar Series podcast at the Harvard Kennedy School.
Hi, should we go ahead and get started? I'm Hannah Riley Bolt. I'm the research director here at the Women in Public Policy Program. Where we are committed to closing gender gaps in economic opportunity, political participation, health, and education. And I have the honor of introducing our seminar speakers, and we're very excited today to have Pinar Fletcher, who is a doctoral candidate in organizational behavior here at Harvard. She is going to talk about competing at all costs, dysfunctional competition, and gender. I've had an opportunity to read a draft of this paper. It's really terrific, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot to talk about. Pinar collaborates closely with a number of WAF affiliates, and I think I'll just leave it there. We're just very excited to hear your work and have you here, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today to listen to our research. This is a research project that I conducted with my co-author Kathleen again, actually, who's here. She's also at Harvard Business School. We looked at gender differences in what we call destructive competitive behavior. We conducted a series of lab experiments, and I'm going to talk about those lab experiments. But before I get into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about what motivated this research and the theory behind that research. As I'm sure many of you in this room know, that women are severely underrepresented at the top of organizations. According to recent Catalyst research, women make up about only 15% of top executives and high earners in Fortune 500 companies. And researchers have been trying to explain this gender gap for some time now. So one stream of research that's also based in the field of behavioral economics, and they conduct a bunch of lab experiments, looked at this issue. And what they did was, in a lab experiment, they asked men and women to choose between a competitor winner-takes-all type of incentive scheme, also known as a tournament type of incentive scheme, that was obviously competitive, and the non-competitive piece rate scheme. In the winner-takes-all competition, the prize was higher. So putting some numbers to illustrate what I mean, people were choosing between a winner-takes-all type of competitive incentive scheme with potentially $4 per output versus working under a piece rate scheme where they would earn just $2 per output. But obviously, if they lost, if they didn't score as well as their competitors in the winner-takes-all scheme, incentive scheme, they would earn nothing. So an overwhelming majority of the men went with the higher-paying competitive winner-takes-all incentive scheme, and the overwhelming majority of women went with the non-competitive, lower-paying piece rate scheme. So based on these findings, researchers argued that the gender gap that I showed you here might be caused not necessarily by a demand-side explanation such as discrimination, but the supply-side explanation such as women's and men's or gender differences in competitive preferences, meaning women are underrepresented in these jobs because they're not applying for these top, high-paying, top competitive jobs in the first place. You probably can tell from my voice that I'm not a huge fan of that explanation. So, to wrap up, this research is saying and showing that men has a higher propensity to compete than women. And subsequent research, as I mentioned, basically problematized women's lower propensity to compete and just focused on researching that. Which is interesting because the same stream of research also shows that a significant chunk of men, by choosing to compete, they're actually losing money they're leaving money on the table by preferring the competitive scheme over the non-competitive piece rate scheme, because these are men who are performing badly. So as a result, when they choose a competitive scheme, they lose and they earn nothing, whereas they would have been better off with the piece rate scheme, where they would, you know, like earn at a lower rate, but they would actually, you know, at least get something for their efforts. So basically, men are actually not always benefiting from their higher propensity to compete. In general, we know from research on competitive preferences, individuals in general, both men and women, to benefit from showing competitive behavior, they need to evaluate their competitive environment carefully and judiciously weigh the benefits of competing against costs of competing, and then make a decision. So, you know, going back to the example that we talked about, before they apply for competitive, high-paying jobs, both men and women, they need to look around. First of all, they need to decide what their qualifications are, who their competitors are, and how they rank against those competitors. Just being competitive reflexively, without and applying for jobs that you might not be qualified for, or getting yourself compared side by side with somebody who is, you know, who has like much superior performance or experience than you, is not necessarily going to help you. In fact, it might hurt you rather than help you. Yet, we know little about men and women's relative ability to evaluate the competitive context with a view towards gauging its benefits against its costs. This is because most research that looked at either competitive behavior or gender differences in competitive behavior, they either focused on types of competitive behavior that conferred pure benefits and no costs to the instigator, mm-hmm. Such as certain types of sabotage behavior where only the person that you're trying to trip up, your competitor, is bearing costs and you're just reaping benefits. Or they looked at a competitive context where there was no variation in terms of expected benefits and costs of displaying competitive behavior. In particular, research focused on the winner-takes-all type of competitive competitions where participants received no information on their performance and how they ranked against their competitors. So no performance feedback and no comparative performance feedback. So in our research, we tried to address this by doing two things. We looked at the type of competitive behavior that was very explicitly associated with both benefits and costs. We looked at destructive competitive behavior, which we define as competitive behavior that aims to hurt the competitor or the competitors, but has the potential to confer net losses or net gains to the instigator. So it's a type of competitive behavior where you're trying to hurt the competitor, but by doing so, you're running the risk of potentially hurting yourself as well. And we also looked at the variety of competitive contexts that varied in terms of expected benefits and costs of displaying competitive behavior. Yes.
That's a quick. Would like a chicken game fall into destructive competitive behavior? Is that how that's been conceptualized in the past?
Chicken game, or you're destroying your colleague's work, but at the expense of potentially getting caught and fired, okay. For example.
Okay.
The idea was to like.
I'm just thinking more in terms of economic models that people might choose from. I was just thinking the chicken game where you're in essence veering toward one another, and if one doesn't give out, they.
I guess the competitive behavior is only coming from, or the behavior that aims to hurt the other competitor is only coming from one side.
It's unidirectional.
Yeah.
And it's just, so it's really sabotage is the essence of what you're focusing primarily on.
So. Yeah, it's a potentially,
with risk
it's
of
a
getting
sabotage-like
caught.
Behavior that has the potential to hurt the saboteur itself,
Risky sabotage, but
exactly.
It's unidirectional risky sabotage.
Exactly.
Just trying to understand exactly what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
So as I mentioned, our aim in doing all of this was to figure out gender differences in ability to evaluate the competitive contexts and women, whether men and women differ in their ability to gauge benefits and costs of displaying this particular type of competitive behavior. In doing so, we were trying to figure out whether men and women can distinguish between contexts where displaying competitive behavior is sort of more dysfunctional from those contexts where displaying competitive behavior is more rational or beneficial. Hence the, I guess, title of our presentation. So we looked at three factors in our research. Organizations typically use these three tools to signal and to set the expected benefits and costs of displaying competitive behavior. They use different types of incentive schemes. They use different types of performance feedback schemes, systems. Number three, they use behavioral norms or established behavioral precedents to signal the benefits and costs of showing competitive behavior within organizations. We primarily focused on two types of competition contexts, high intensity and low intensity. High intensity competitions use winner-takes-all incentive schemes with high social comparison or highly comparative performance feedback. A typical example of a winner-takes-all type of incentive scheme would be employee of the month award or some type of promotion systems where the top performer or the top performers get everything recognized and the so-called losers, they get nothing for their efforts, essentially. A typical example of a high social comparison or highly comparative performance feedback system is a 360-degree review. Here, a focal individual's performance is explicitly and emphatically compared to those of others. Here, both the incentive scheme and the performance feedback system emphasize, recognize, and reward only performance relative to others. Individuals get the signal that their own individual performance is only important in relation to how they perform against others. In contrast, in low-intensity competitions, variable reward schemes and no social comparison or non-comparative performance feedback systems are used. Under the variable, so here, this is still a competitive environment, but individuals feel that their individual accomplishments in growth and performance still matter, regardless of how they rank against others. So, for example, in a variable reward scheme, the top performers would get recognized in that they would earn at a higher rate, or they would, you know, get more for their efforts. But everybody else would still be getting paid or rewarded in line with their performance. A typical example of a variable reward scheme would be like a bonus or profit sharing scheme.
Do the two factors you have to go together, the winner takes all with high comparison or variable with low comparison? I'm thinking about certain, you know, making partner or making tenure, where at the end there's certainly a winner-take-all, but along the way, there's not necessarily high social comparison.
Yeah, so we are essentially focused on these two competitive contexts. And
but they don't have to go together.
Yeah, they don't have to go together, but you can see that how they can actually go together in terms of emphasizing performance relative to others. So what we did was this was our initial focus, and then we looked at different combinations. So I guess back to low-intensity competitions and what I mean by non-comparative, no-social comparison performance feedback systems. So here, an individual would get reviewed or would get feedback in relation to how he or she did over time. for relative to a more objective defined performance benchmark such as an organizational goal or a personal goal. To clarify that a little bit further, let's say there's a sales organization and there's a salesperson. The salesperson might be told, you sold X this year versus you sold Y last year. Whereas in the high social comparison performance feedback, the same person would be told, you sold X this year, whereas your peer or your peers sold Y. In high intensity competitions, individuals get strong, clear cues that winning and beating their competitors, doing better than their competitors, is everything. As a result, expected benefits of being competitive or showing destructive competitive behavior and trying to trip up your competitor has a relatively high expected benefit. And consequently, it has a relatively low expected cost. The benefits and costs are also relatively certain because of the incentive scheme and because of the high social comparison performance feedback, because you know where you stand relative to your competitors. In contrast, in low intensity competitions, you're getting more weak, ambiguous signals as to the appropriateness or optimality of engaging in such destructive competitive behavior. For example, incentive scheme tells you that winning is good, but even if you don't do better than others, that's okay as long as you maximize your own potential because you're still getting paid in relation to your performance. Expected benefits in general, expected net payoffs of engaging in destructive competitive behavior are relatively low and uncertain. Given that expected net payoffs of engaging in destructive competitive behavior are significantly higher in high intensity competitions than in low intensity competitions, we predicted that such behavior would be a lot more often to a higher degree, to a significantly higher degree in high intensity competitions than in low intensity competitions. However, we predicted that this relationship between gender and competition intensity would actually be qualified or would be moderated by the gender of the focal individual who's making the decision. And this part, I'm going to explain how we think about this interaction effect a little bit more in detail next. So some situations are strong. What I mean by that is that in strong situations, people get clear, unambiguous cues that about the optimal or appropriate kind of behavior. Meaning, people know or they get very strong cues that behaving a certain way is going to maximize their individual payoffs. In these kind of situations, these strong situational effects dominate people's behavior and leave no room for individual differences such as gender-based differences. So in these kind of strong situations, both men and women taking their cues from the situation, they behave similarly. And as a result, you usually do not observe any kind of significant gender-based differences in behavior. In contrast, in weak situations, individuals get ambiguous and mixed signals about how to behave and what is likely to optimize their individual outcomes. When situational cues are weak and mixed like this, it leaves room for gender-based differences to creep in. In these kind of situations, both men and women, they start listening in and behaving more according to gender-based prescriptions. So what do these gender-based prescriptions tell us? For men, these gender-based norms dictate that men act competitively and assertively, be achievement-oriented, be individualistic. In contrast, these same gender differences tell us that women should be mindful of others' interests, be other-oriented, communal, and more. Because of this, in weak situations, men and women's behaviors start diverging, and we see significant gender differences. Favorite research that shows this effect actually is research conducted by Hannah and my co-author Kathleen McGinn with Linda Babcock. There they looked at gender differences in negotiation performance, and they found that when there was no ambiguity about like which issues can be brought to the negotiation table or that the negotiating was appropriate at all, men and women behaved equally assertively and they performed equally well. But when there was ambiguity about what can be negotiated, then women started pulling back and they acted less assertively in negotiations. And as a result, men had a better performance in negotiations than women.
Competitive negotiations.
So obviously, in our case, competition in that intensity is a strong situational cue. High intensity competitions are strong situations. Here, expected payoffs of displaying destructive competitive behavior are relatively high and certain. So men and women, they both get clear, strong signals, cues that they should behave competitively, engage in destructive competitive behavior to maximize their individual payoffs. So we expect no gender differences in situations like this. In low intensity competitions, the situation is worse. Here, individuals are getting mixed signals about the appropriateness or optimality of engaging in destructive competitive behavior. Expected payoffs from destructive competition are relatively low and uncertain. So here we expect men, in general, in competitive environments, there isn't a conflict between gender-based norms for men and competition. Men are expected to behave competitively and assertively and be achievement-oriented. So we expect men to continue to show reflexive competitive behavior in these type of environments, whereas we predict women to take a step back and evaluate the competition context more consciously and start paying attention to gender-based norms, which dictate that they should be other-oriented, communal, and fair. So we expect to see a gender difference here. So this formally translates into a significant interaction effect between gender and competition intensity, such that in low-intensity competitions, men would show a higher propensity for destructive competitive behavior than women. Women in high-intensity competitions would show a significantly higher propensity for destructive competition than in low-intensity competitions. So to put this interaction differently into, I guess, like English, we expect women to change their behavior in response to the changes in the competitive environment, whereas we expect men to continue to show similar reflexive competitive behavior across different competition contexts. As I mentioned, behavioral norms are another regulator of competitive behavior or destructive competitive behavior in organizations. They, just like incentive schemes and performance feedback systems, they signal expected benefits and costs of displaying such deviant behavior as destructive competitive behavior. So for example, if an employee sees that her boss is engaging in destructive competitive behavior, she would be more likely to emulate that kind of behavior, thinking, oh, you know, this is being rewarded in this type of organization. But we know from past research that looked at the influence of these behavioral norms, they tend to be effective only in weak situations and low-intensity competitions. So we also looked at how behavioral norms affected this type of destructive competition, individuals' destructive competitive behavior. And we also looked at how these behavioral norms affect the gender gap in behavior we saw earlier, or we are predicting. And we still, given that this is a weak situation, we predicted that there would still be differences in how men and women react to these behavioral norms. So again, formally, we're in low-intensity competitions. We're predicting that behavioral norms or precedents established by others would be emulated by the observers, meaning competitive norms will increase such behavior, and non-competitive norms will decrease such behavior. But again, given that this is a weak situation, low-intensity competition, we expect both men and women to be more responsive to the behavioral norms that correspond to their respective gender norms. So this is a roadmap of our studies. In study one and study two, we examined the effect of competition intensity. And in study three, we isolated low-intensity competitions, and we looked at how behavioral norms affect men and women's behavior in those situations. So in our lab experiments, we paired participants with a competitor. We held the competitor constant. It was the same person, it was a real person. It was a person who performed relatively well in the task we assigned participants. Specifically, that person was performing about one standard deviation above average, because we wanted to give all participants across conditions a reason to ponder engaging in destructive competition. We gave participants this somewhat annoying task of what we call a CAPTCHA task. We gave them these random alphanumeric codes, and they were supposed to look at see these codes on the screen, and we typed them as fast as they can because they were operating under time pressure. And they were given a practice round of this task before they started, and then they moved on to the paid rounds. So in study one, we had a 2x2 between subjects design. Participants were male and female participants were assigned either to a high-intensity competition condition or a low-intensity competition condition. In high-intensity competition, winner-takes-all incentive scheme was used along with high social comparison feedback. Under the winner-takes-all incentive scheme, participants learned that in each round, they would earn 3 cents per CAPTCHA that they transcribed, provided that they score higher than their counterpart. And under the high social comparison feedback system, at the end of each round, they learned what their score was in that round and their competitor's score. In contrast, in low intensity, they got paid under variable reward scheme, and they learned that, again, they were going to get 3 cents per CAPTCHA transcribed if they scored better than their counterpart, but if they didn't, they were going to still get 2 cents per CAPTCHA transcribed. Under the no social comparison feedback system, at the end of each score, they learned their current score in that round and what they did in the previous round. So here we were giving them essentially information on how they performed across time, and we tried to focus them on trying to do their own best.
So it's not complete no social comparison, right? Because they know if they get 3 cents, they know that they did better than their competitor?
Oh, so they don't learn what they have earned until the very end of the experiment.
Oh, I see. So you, but so then can,
so these
sorry,
guys
but these guys are every round or something they are learning?
I'm sorry?
These guys every round they find out or something? Like how often are these guys getting the social comparison information?
In the high social comparison?
Yeah.
At the end of each round. So
at the end of
each,
okay, and these guys just do multiple rounds not knowing anything.
Exactly.
I see.
And now there's another question.
The person that they were competing against, was that always the same person, or was it sometimes male and sometimes female?
No, so it was the same person. It was a real person. And it was a relatively well-performing individual. And we gave that information completely gender-neutral. completely gender neutral ways. And the ask part is bonus at the very end if they assume anything about the gender of their counterpart. And most people didn't, and that didn't have any, that didn't seem to have any effect on their behavior, but I'll talk more about that later. So this was the flow of the study.
Just one comment on this question. The low social comparison treatment was getting in. It was getting parallel information every round. It was just information about their own performance alone. The other was getting information about the other side's performance. You don't actually know if these captures, you know, sort of how they're doing as you go along. So it wasn't like they were just sitting there getting no information. They were just getting feedback on their own performance.
Not payment, just feedback.
Just feedback on their own performance.
Yeah, yeah. So you just tell, like, you did so many. And then they don't know whether they got 2 or 3 cents until the end. Right. Yeah, yeah. That's where I got confused. It wasn't clear if they were getting their 3 cents. If they were getting their 3 cents, then they would know. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering, in high intensity and in low intensity, so did you say they're both getting information about, like, who they're competing against or no?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Like, are they both getting information about, like, who they're competing against? Did you say that?
So everybody knew that they were competing against somebody.
Like, did they know who, like, what I'm saying? Like, who it would be, or...?
They just know that the same person
participated
in the same study under the same conditions, under the same instructions, set of instructions, and under the same set of rules.
Okay.
So this was the flow of the experiment. Participants completed the practice round 1, round 2, and then... just before they started round 3, they were asked to make a decision. Essentially, so this was our main dependent variable where we studied the propensity for destructive competition. Essentially, what they could deduct up to 16 points from their competitor's next round score. But if they did so, they lost points from their own score up to 5 points. And higher point deductions were more costly. So at the one extreme, they could deduct up to 16 points from the participant's next score, but then they would lose 5 points from their own score. And at the other end of the extreme, they can choose not to engage in destructive competition at all. So they don't deduct any points from the other person's next score, and they don't lose anything from their own score. These were our findings. We're looking here at the points that participants chose to deduct from the other person just before they started performing in that round. As you can see, as we predicted, men's behavior did not seem to change across different competition structures, whereas women showed a significantly lower propensity for destructive competition in low intensity than in high intensity, which created the significant gender difference we see in low intensity competitions. Next, we looked at the actual net payoffs, the net profits or losses the participants were able to reap from these point deductions from engaging in destructive competition. So obviously people are making more money in high-intensity competitions than in low-intensity competitions. But there's a significant interaction effect between competition and gender. Women women's payoffs, because their behavior is responsive to what's going on in the structural in the competition structure, they are earning more. They're reaping more benefits from point deductions from engaging in destructive competition.
Can you explain how the sabotage? I'm trying to like understand. Well, both first in like the technical sense, how when they engage in this, that under what conditions does that benefit you?
Yeah.
And then, so that's and then, secondly, like I'm trying to like relate as you go along to like what these examples might look like in like the working world. So like Hannah's example of like sabotage, like that idea of someone catches you, you lose. But like, what would this type of situation look like in a real world?
So yeah, thank you for reminding me. I actually meant to talk about that. So I guess I'll talk about some extreme examples to make a little bit more sense of, you know, when participants get a profit versus a loss. So one extreme, if you are if you're in a high competition intensity condition and you're working on the winner takes all incentive scheme, and you deduct points, and because you deduct points, you win, and then you make a bonus that you wouldn't have made otherwise if you didn't deduct points because you would have lost. You are making a pure profit from engaging in destructive competition. So I guess in the real world, let's say, I know that there's like a request for proposal, and each employee who's at the same level, they're expected to prepare a proposal to respond to this. And you know that the person who creates the winning solution for the client, they're going to get a promotion. So you prepare it, and then, you know, like your main competitor, your chief competitor, you know, prepares something, and then just before the day of presentation, you go and, you know, either fiddle with her numbers or something, or you just like completely destroy, delete whatever her presentation, and because of that, you get the promotion and she loses out. So that would be equal to that.
But don't you lose points too, right, in the game, right?
Yeah.
So
you lose points, but you would have made zero anyway in that situation. So essentially, the cost is zero. So in the real world example, if you were caught, then you would have borne that cost and probably got fired. But because you didn't, and you end up getting promotion, it's a pure profit.
I'm wondering how analogous it really is, because if I was playing a game and felt like part of the strategy of the game was to deduct points from other people, that wouldn't be like an ethical question for me. It would just be like, oh, I'm playing this game. Whereas like just deleting my competitor's presentation would be this huge, like, there's no way I would consider doing that. So to me, in the game, I could totally see myself being like, ooh, what's the best strategy here? I'm playing a game.
So obviously, you know, this is an abstraction, it's an experiment, and that's why I've been choosing my words very carefully, and I actually did not use the word sabotage. It's more like a sabotage-like behavior, and it's because, partly because of that, because it's almost like, you know, we're kind of like allowing it, it's undone by the experimenter, so it doesn't have the same illicit or illegitimate connotation of destroying.
So to the, maybe another analogy would be going negative in a campaign. So winner takes all campaign, doing negative campaigning. Negative campaigning is risky to me because it's not that positively perceived, but I get to hurt the other thing. That might be, maybe that's a stronger real life analogy.
Yeah.
Can you go back though to your, or just the slide right before this? Like, why are the women doing better in high intensity if there's no gender difference in behavior in high intensity?
Second experiment will explain why.
Okay.
You know, just to give you a preview, it's because they're paying attention to where they rank against their competitors, and men are just not paying any attention.
Okay. So what you see. All right. Good.
Women are sabotaging, if I can use the word sabotage, when it will be useful.
Exactly.
And men are just.
Reflexively
sabotaging. Thanks for saying that. It's really hard for us to say.
That's fascinating.
So, any other questions?
It'd be fascinating. I have a propensity to like bribing. It would be fascinating to actually look at if you go back one slide, particularly on the left-hand side, to see the frequency distributions of the impact of the sabotage rules.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To just get a slightly better feel for this enormous
difference.
Yeah,
that makes
difference.
Sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
So to wrap up the final
And so this says benefits reaped from destructive competition. So is this only in incorporating the data points where the person did engage in the
sabotage behavior? Yeah, so how we calculated it is what I should have actually said when I before I validated the results. So this is a bonus that participants, additional bonus participants were able to reap from destructive competition minus any bonus that they foregone because they deducted points from the other person. So if you have not engaged in any point deductions, is basically 0 minus 0, 0.
Got it. Okay.
So there are a bunch of zeros.
Got it.
About 50% of the people don't engage, so they're like 50% of the data is zeros.
Yep.
So just to wrap up these findings, it seems like women, they're more attuned to what's going on in the competitive environment, they're more attuned to the competition context and structure. As a result, they're changing their behavior significantly, whereas men, they seem to be behaving somewhat reflexively and showing a similar propensity for destructive competitive behavior across competition conditions. And because of that, women are reaping more net benefits or more net payoffs from engaging in such behavior than men. In study two, going back to your question, we separated the incentive scheme and performance feedback system and manipulated them separately. So what that ended up, what we ended up with was a 2x2x2 between subjects design. But the instructions, the study procedures were exactly the same otherwise. So here participants, male and female participants, they were assigned either to a variable reward scheme or a winner-takes-all incentive scheme. And then separately, they were randomly assigned either to a high social comparison or no social comparison condition. The results on point deductions or the men and women's propensity for destructive competitive behavior. So, you know, obviously men are the blue bars, and as you can see, there's a remarkable consistency across conditions, whereas women's is the green, and it's almost like a downward stepwise function. And, you know, again, we're replicating findings from our first study. We essentially did not have these two middle bars in the previous study. We just looked at these two extreme cases. And we are replicating these findings. No gender differences here in high intensity, and significant gender differences in low intensity caused by women's tendency to change their behavior, their responsiveness to what's going on in the competitive context, whereas no change here. And again, we looked at the net profits or losses, net payoffs that participants were able to reap from these point deductions from destructive competition. Again, we calculated it the same way. Any additional bonus participants were able to get, minus any bonus that they gave up because they chose to deduct points. Incentive scheme, social comparison or the performance feedback, and gender, they all mattered. They all had a significant main effect on the net payoffs reaped. But all of these main effects were qualified by one, a significant two-way interaction between gender and social comparison, availability of social comparison, and a marginally significant three-way interaction between all of these three factors and the two-way interaction between gender and incentive scheme. So putting that in English, what we find is that women are significantly more able than or more competent in factoring in social comparison information into their decision making before they engage in this type of destructive competition. But that, in fact, is qualified by that three-way interaction. So essentially, women are particularly adept at doing so, factoring the social comparison information and where they stand against their competitors in under winner-takes-all incentive schemes. Putting that differently, men seem to appear to factor in the type of incentive scheme that they're working under to some extent, although not as effectively as women, but they are factoring in, they're not factoring in the social comparison information, the information on their competitors at all when they make their decision.
Could you say a little bit about your population? Are all those women and men the same, or how did you sample your
participants? So these first two studies were conducted on Amazon's mechanical turk platform. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So they're basically like an American population. They were all adults between the ages of, I think, 18 and 65, with an average age of about 30. And that's pretty much all I know from on this experiment, but there are a bunch of people who conducted research on who these people are. And they tend to be pretty representative in terms of like where they live, etc. They actually tend to be like fairly well-educated and obviously very computer literate people. Most of them tend to have at least some college education. And what else? But they tend to be low-income Americans.
All low-income?
Not all low-income, but like low to average income, I would say. These things, studies on the Mechanical Turk, they don't pay that much. You're essentially getting paid, I think, like $6 to $7 per hour. So you're, you know, like people who, you know, be willing to do a job for minimum wage. It's basically what you should.
You also look for differences within the group of men and the group of women? In group differences?
I don't understand that. What do you mean?
Did you find?
Oh, I see.
Variation.
Like age. I didn't look at that at all.
Okay.
Yeah. And I guess like one more thing, they tend to be white.
Okay.
Overwhelmingly white. So our next study, we did actually at Harvard's lab, and we get the same results. So any other questions? As I mentioned, another tool that organizations use to regulate this kind of competitive behavior, or almost like a given type of competitive behavior, is through established behavioral precedents or behavioral norms. As I mentioned, past research shows that they tend to be effective in low intensity competitions and weak situations, so that's what we looked at. As a reminder, we expected, you know, behavioral norms and behavioral precedents to be imitated by observers, and we expected to find gender differences given the situationally weak environment. So in this study, we took male and female participants, and they were randomly assigned to one of the three behavioral norm conditions. So this is essentially a two by three between subjects design. So the no behavioral norm condition is essentially the control condition, and this is almost exactly the same condition as in the low intensity competition condition in the previous two studies. So this is what we're doing different here. Here, participants in the non-competitive behavioral normal condition, participants observed another participant, somebody we designated as a leader, refrain from destructive competition. This person was given an option to engage in point deductions, but this person chose not to engage in destructive competition or point deductions. In the competitive behavioral norm condition, the reverse happened. Participants saw that the participant was given an option to engage in destructive competition, and they did so to the fullest extent. They deducted the maximum number of points. So this was the flow of the experiment. Again, they did the same task, practice round one. And then just before round two, we asked them to make a decision about point deductions again, exactly the same way, using the same options. So here we measured their baseline propensity for destructive competition. And then they completed round two, and then they were assigned to one of the three behavioral norm conditions. If they were in the no behavioral norm control condition, they just, you know, continued on through the experiment. But if they were in one of the competitive or non-competitive behavioral norm conditions, they made that observation about the other person's behavior, and then they were given the decision to engage or not engage in point deductions before round three. So this is our main area of interest here. We want to see how their behavior changed from the baseline to this after potentially observing a behavioral norm depending on what condition that they were assigned. So this is the main effect of behavioral norms on propensity for destructive competition. So this here is our control condition, and as we predicted, those participants who observed the non-competitive behavioral norm significantly decreased their propensity for destructive competition. Contrary to our predictions, competitive behavioral norms did not have a significant effect on people's propensity for destructive competition. So this comparison is significant, but this is not. So next, as you might remember, we had predicted that men and women would be influenced differently based on because gender prescriptions for men and women are different. So this is what we study here. I guess before I get into this, I should say that, so this over here, before the influence of any behavioral norms, this essentially replicated our results. Men were significantly more likely than women to engage in destructive competition. So now we're looking at how that changed. So comparing women in the control condition, the women in non-competitive behavioral norm condition, we see a significant decrease. And comparing men in the control condition to men in the competitive behavioral norm condition, we see a significant difference in behavior. So just as we predicted, women were only responsive to the non-competitive behavioral norms, and men were only significantly responsive to competitive behavioral norms. And as you can see, just this is the control condition, the gap actually decreases a little bit between men and women. There's like a little bit of a reversal in behavior. In round three, men are, if they do not observe any behavioral norm at all, men are actually decreasing their propensity a little bit, and women are increasing it a little bit. But the gender gap is still very significant despite this reversal.
Did you experiment at all with making these norms that's like explicitly gendered, like saying, you know, women don't really compete, so
yeah,
or like
so yeah. I wish we had done anything like that. We just talked about this other person in gender neutral terms.
Yeah,
and just left it at that. And even, I don't think even like asked what they told the gender of that person was.
And I'm just thinking of those studies like with the math tests and stuff where they tell girls beforehand, like, you know, girls aren't really good at this test, and then they actually perform worse.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I wondered if you like gave explicitly gendered cues about performance or behavior.
Yeah, that would be interesting. So what we find about how people think about gender without unprompted, because we asked about their competitor and what they thought about their competitor, we find that 70 to 75%, they actually say that, like, well, I haven't thought about the gender of the other person at all. So the rest, 30 to 25%, they assume something. So those who assume something, they're more likely to think that the other person is male. I have a somewhat of a Jewish interest in linguistics, so that's pretty typical why you don't tell anything about the gender of a person in the male-dominated society. They tend to think that that person is a male. The interesting thing is, despite that effect, men tend to think that their competitor is a man, and women tend to think that their competitor is a woman. So, make of that you have, kind of. No. So that would be interesting.
That's a question.
I was just wondering, in the no leader condition, it almost looks like the behaviors are sort of self-affected, like they get you running, sort of having to do the task.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you saw any changes over time.
Yeah. So I think, so that is not a significant difference, but neither for men nor for women. But I think if you kept on doing that, I think, or I would hope that people would start, you know.
Yeah, if you have a sense like whether the gender difference is, it's you're sort of capturing that initial reaction.
Yeah.
But then like people would adapt to the condition.
Yeah. So it seems like at least two times in quick succession, it doesn't, you know, remove the gender gap. But that doesn't mean that it won't completely disappear if you keep on doing that. But I have to say that I would be careful about that because, I mean, I would like to study that. I don't know what the answer is. But you need to be a little careful about the conclusion, too, because how often are you exactly in the same situation in the real world? So if the situation is a little bit different, people might still revert to their initial reaction. So.
Go back to studies one and two. I think that your enormous result.
Which one? The
that women do better when they sabotage on the left hand side. Would that work with just male and female Harvard undergraduates? I know you don't know the answer, but
I don't know the answer, but I know that. I did the same experiment in low intensity competition condition only, and it worked.
So I'm wondering whether this is a sabotage result, or women are dramatically more sensitive and therefore more effective at identifying how to behave in mixed motive contexts. And if it's the latter, the reason I asked about Harvard was to do a better job of controlling for other variables. So on MTurk, gender could correlate with lots of different things. If you only had Harvard undergraduates, then you control for most of those things.
Yeah.
And so there's something kind of fascinating about the sensitivity of women to the environment that they're in.
Yeah. So that's the question we're not answering. We're saying, the conclusion we're drawing is that women are more sensitive to the competitive environment, or it could be that they're just more sensitive to their social environment in general.
Right, but what you have here on the left-hand side is an enormous result for the superiority of women in a profit-making context based on their social sensitivity. I don't think that I've ever seen that in any environment. And the question is whether that generalizes to lots of other tasks where you need to, where the behavior of the other side might be predictable based on the past, where women would pay attention to that and men would lose that. And I'm thinking about the, so Neil Buff and Brandenberger have this book on co-opetition, which is all about identifying when you need to cooperate with your competitors.
Yeah.
And sort of in that whole class of real-world environments and a large number of games that people think of, would women do a better job if you gave them some information about the opponent?
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting question. Like somewhat related research that actually that's not published from London Business School. What they actually did in their study is they did something bad to men and women. Like they get they essentially got screwed by somebody, and in a competitive game, and then they moved them to a cooperative game, and women were actually a lot less likely to mention, to forget, like, what happened. So I don't think, I mean, that's, you know, like, just very preliminary research, so I don't think it, you know, extends, these results would extend to all kind of situations, but I mean, I don't know. So Nederland and Westerland's research, they showed that the research that motivated all of this, they showed that both men and women, they make bad decisions before they enter into competitive games. Men, they just act so overconfidently, although being bad performance, and they lose money that way. And a bunch of women, they act underconfidently, and they lose money because of that. So I don't think these results can unfortunately be like generalized to everything. But I don't know the answer.
No, I think there's other. I think even if you go back to like the old like Rubin and Brown, they were this. They looked at all these. They did all these. Kind of like, you know, gender as personality studies, and actually women, the results are very similar to what you describe. You know, women not, men actually changing their play in games with, you know, cooperative potential, and women not, you know, like persisting in retaliation after defection and stuff like that. So, I mean, so you don't, and you also actually the results on gender and integrative problem solving don't really favor women necessarily. There's certainly no evidence of women being better. If anything, some people would like to argue men are better based on the results. So the pattern, to exactly to your point, I mean, just adding a little bit more grist to your argument, it doesn't.
Yeah.
What about like a Schadenfreude effect for men, or like
a
Schadenfreude effect, like got him. You know, like the
Schadenfreude,
meaning joy in somebody
else's
pain.
Oh, oh, oh.
You know, or like the video game effect or something like that. You know, like do that. One thing I wonder is, so you look at these things, so the men are making a trade off. Like, let's just assume they're somewhat rational. Like, maybe they get such a kick out of this game where you bust the other guy that they don't even care what they win. They're like, I will pay you a dollar to just bust on this guy for 10 minutes.
Do you have some qualitative data that I'm going to talk about?
Yeah. Oh, good. Don't let it slow you down.
That's not the case.
Oh, good. Yeah.
But I mean, it's not conclusive evidence.
If you have more stuff, you should show us. So we don't want to. We kind of thought you were at the end. Keep going.
Okay. So what we did in all of these studies, at the very end of the study, we asked participants why they chose to deduct or not deduct any points without, you know, any prompts. So then we went and looked at those answers, and we coded them, and some common themes emerged. So for deducting points, those who actually chose to deduct points, a very overwhelming majority, 90 to 95% across studies, and these patterns were pretty consistent across different studies with two different populations. They used a utilitarian, pragmatic, self-serving type of justification, like, you know, like I thought I would, you know, like win this much, I would lose this much, so I went and did it. It's like, or simply something like, oh, I just wanted to get more bonus. And not very surprisingly, you're a lot more likely to come across an explanation like this in high-intensity competitions than in low-intensity competitions. And the very interesting thing here is that we find a significant gender difference, but there is no gender difference in high-intensity competitions. Gender difference emerges only in low-intensity, meaning women are probably realizing this no longer makes pragmatic sense. I'm not sure why. Maybe they're just thinking like, oh, we should be fair. This is a nasty thing to do. Or because they're like, oh, hold on a second, this just doesn't make no longer make sense. It won't create a profit in the same environment. And looking at the payoffs, it seems like they are thinking about payoffs, but can't really decide that conclusively, I think. So another 5% of them claim that they deducted points because of some sort of like other directed strategic reasoning, something along the lines of like, oh, I deducted points because I thought the other person would deduct points, so I was like trying to counteract that. So for not deducting any points, or not, so these are the people that did not engage in destructive competition. The leading explanation was a concern for fairness. Women were a lot more likely to mention a concern for fairness than men, especially in low-intensity competitions. So I think the parallel thing is happening there as well. Rather than making a very pragmatic calculation, some of them are just saying, when it doesn't, maybe they're also just like being reflexive. When it no longer makes sense, when the situation effects are not dominant, maybe rather than thinking very rationally about it, they might just be pulling back because like, hold on, this is not fair. So I'm not sure. So the next reason that rationale people mentioned, which had a very high overlap with the first category, was a concern for the other. So this was like typically mentioned along with like, I want to be fair, and then they would tackle in a sentence like, I don't want to do that to the other person. It's a bad thing to do to another person. And then the third explanation, which is, I think, pretty interesting, is like a utilitarian, pragmatic reason for not engaging in destructive competition. So this was about 25% of the participants. So this is like, oh, I thought I was gonna win anyway, or I was winning anyway, so why would I engage in point deductions and leave money on the table by doing so? And women were a lot more likely than men to say something along these lines. And so this last thing pertains only to the last study we ran, the behavioral norms. When people observe competitive behavioral norms, these gender differences between men and women about the concern for fairness, concern for the other, they disappear. People.
I just want a question of clarification. Maybe I missed that you explained this and I missed this, but they're playing against the same person all the time, and then they see how they did. But do they deduct points from the other side? But is it like, is the point reduction, do they presume that's invisible? And the other side, because the other side never reduces points, right?
Yeah.
So they
don't know that view.
So they're kind of doing point reductions blindly,
yeah,
without knowing whether the other side is reducing points on them, and the other side never reduces points on them.
We left them just ambiguous at this point in these preliminary studies. Well, it does seem like people are really like not paying that much attention to the, what happens next with the other person. It's only 5% of the people who, didn't prompt them specifically about like, oh, what did you think the, other person was gonna do? How did that factor into your decision? But unprompted, only like 5% of the people brought that into discussion. So I already talked about this a little bit. It seemed like most people didn't assume anything about the gender of their counterpart, and those who assumed something, it didn't seem to have any effect on their behavior. So to recap all of our findings, We're finding that women's competitive behaviors are more context dependent. They seem to be more attuned to the competition structure.
Just the top of the hour.
5 minutes,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And as a result, they adjust their behavior, and because they adjust their behavior in response to what goes on in the competitive environment, they reap more benefits from their behavior than men. So this kind of, you know, goes back to how I opened up the discussion. Men do not always benefit from their less selective and higher propensity to compete. We also think that our results might shed some light into seemingly contradictory findings in the literature. So past research found that women, they do not like to compete. They shy away from competitive environments, but they can be very competitive with each other to the point of blocking or sabotaging each other, as in the so-called queen bee syndrome. So we think that there is research by Rogan Ely that shows that this kind of queen bee type of behavior, sabotaging or blocking each other women, they tend to happen in male-dominated organizations. So we think that what might be going on in women's minds is that they might feel like they're in a low-intensity competition with their relatively numerous male colleagues, and in a high-intensity competition with their few and more salient female colleagues, winner takes all, with high social comparison between the two of them. So as a result, ironically, they might be more likely to engage in sabotage-like behavior towards their male colleagues than their female colleagues.
You mean the other way around?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes. and that would actually, ironically, exacerbate the gender gap in these organizations.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
And finally, I guess more generally, these results also seem to show some unintended negative effects of some motivational tools that organizations commonly use, such as 360 reviews or upper promotion policies to a certain extent. It seems like organizations might be better off with structuring their inter-organization competitions as low intensity, but they also need to keep in mind that that might actually create a gender gap. So I mentioned some of these things already, so rather than talking about these, are there any last questions, maybe comments?
We only have a minute, so why don't you kind of wrap up with your...
This is something I already mentioned when Max asked his question. So we saw that men's behavior was not responsive to changes in the competition environment. So we concluded that men are not responsive to the changes in the competitive environment. But we didn't compare their behavior between a competitive and non-competitive situation. It might be that they're just not paying that much attention to their social context in general. So we don't know if it's the competitive context or the social context in general that they're not paying attention to. And finally, we also just, you know, looked at the ratio between the prizes in winner-takes-all and variable reward schemes was a constant ratio across all studies. So as a result, the expected payoffs from each type of incentive scheme was constant. So we're kind of generalizing results based on that, but it might be interesting to shrink or expand that expected payoffs between different competitive situations and see, you know, like maybe if the gap, you know, gets wider, we might, you know, see more sensitivity in men's behavior, so on and so forth. So it's sort of like, you know, running a sensitivity analysis on these results would be helpful. I guess finally, there are some other managerial tools that can be used in the real world to counter this kind of behavior. We just use behavioral norms, but obviously organizations, they can allow explicit punishments or rewards for this kind of behavior. So you might be able to get different results using other such explicit, stronger managerial tools.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was terrific. Thank you. Next week, please join us. Deborah Rohde, is a professor of law at Stanford University, is going to talk on the big question of what women want. Yeah, we're going to hear about that.